very quickly that that was not the case and that we were doing very, it was a bad war and we should not have been there
telling
people
you?
What to do. I was in eastern Afghanistan for the first deployment, western Afghanistan for the second. So I did not see combat, but as a military intelligence collector, I saw plenty of the decisions that got people killed on both sides that didn't need to happen. So I came back very disillusioned, like a lot of people, and actually like the ICE agent that I spoke to, which, by the way, this interview wasn't actually part of the hiring process. It was an optional step to see if I wanted to join up. But he told me that he was also joined right out of high school. He also deployed. And when he got back, he also got out as soon as he could. He didn't want anything to do with the military. But he had a lot of trouble assimilating, as a lot of veterans do. And so about 6 months later, he decided to go for law enforcement. And the rest is history. He's been an ICE agent, he said, for about a decade. He likes the work. He feels like he's getting instant results. And this is very sad to me and also emblematic of a problem we have where we use this language of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction and freedom and democracy at the barrel of a gun. We did this overseas, and it's come home in every conceivable way.
Talk about your concerns about them not doing a background check. I mean, what does this mean for people who are documented to, well, wife beaters, people kill women?
Yeah, I mean, it's very funny that they hired a lefty journalist with a profile on an Antifa watch. That's hilarious. But what's not funny is they didn't make me sign a domestic violence waiver. So how many people with domestic violence convictions are running around with guns in our cities terrorizing people? How many people who have been committed of sex crimes or crimes against children are in charge of detention centers where people, there's no oversight, where people won't be missed and won't be believed? The horror, it boggles the mind how bad this really is.
And you were hired to be a deportation officer. What exactly is that? Where would you serve?
Yeah. So, deportation officer. Basically, the agent was very keen on letting me know that I wouldn't be given a badge and a gun right away. I wouldn't be out in the street messing people up. I would probably have to push paperwork for about 6 months before I got there. And when I expressed that that was fine with me, with my analyst background, he actually, the atmosphere changed. He was like, no, listen, we want everyone on the street with guns eventually. And I had to reassure him that that was also fine. It seems like the focus is very much getting people out on the street with guns, and the focus of the people applying, apparently, is to get out on the street as quickly as possible to brutalize people.
I'll just end by asking you. You said you signed up to fight the war on terror, and you served twice in Afghanistan. You call what's happening here in the United States the war on terror come home.
Yes. It is very sad. It is not surprising, but it is very sad. This is a national emergency. This is a state emergency. And frankly, it's past time that governors called up the National Guard to protect the citizens who elected them to keep them safe from the people actually terrorizing us in the streets.
Laura Jadid, I want to thank you for being with us. Freelance journalist who writes regularly on her Substack at firewalledmedia.com. We'll link to your new piece for Slate, which is headlined, "You've heard about who ICE is recruiting. The truth is far worse. I'm the proof." We'll link to it at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now more at how ICE is recruiting thousands of new deportation officers. A report by The Washington Post shows ICE plans to spend $100 million for a, quote, wartime recruitment strategy that targets gun rights supporters, military enthusiasts through online influencers, along with people who've attended UFC fights, listened to far-right podcasts, or shown interest in guns and tactical gear. It uses the ad industry technique known as geofencing to send ads to people near military bases, NASCAR races, college campuses, or gun shows. Some of ICE's recruitment ads appear to refer to white nationalist slogans or openly quote them. After ICE agent Jonathan Ross killed Renee Good in Minneapolis, an ad on ICE's Instagram account claimed, quote, "We'll have our home again," and featured a song popular among white nationalists with lyrics about reclaiming our home by blood or sweat. Our next guest is investigative reporter Ken Klippenstein. He has a new report headlined "Immigration Agents Terrified of ICE Backlash After Shooting" that includes leaked documents showing ICE and Border Patrol are seeking volunteers for the surge in operations in Minneapolis, with one agent saying, quote, keyword, is it's on a voluntary basis. If no experienced senior agents step up, they send the new guys straight out of the academy. Not a good idea, unquote. Welcome back, Ken. Lay out what you found.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me. Well, one of the most surprising parts of reporting on this was seeing the disjunct between the Department of Homeland Security's public-facing description of the shooting, this bravado they had, Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem immediately labeling her a terrorist and pretty much dragging her corpse through the streets as she, sullied her name in the public consciousness, again, within just a couple of hours of the shooting. And then you talk to people that work for Homeland Security privately, and a very different picture emerges. They're very conscious of the protests that are taking place in Minneapolis. They're very concerned about it. And there's splits within the agency about the shooting itself and the general mission. The reason they are going to these volunteers is because they're worried about sending more experienced agents there who might not agree with the mission. And none of that is stuff you hear when you look at the public-facing officials in the Trump administration describing these incidents and the department.
Talk about the budget, the massive increase in the budget that, by the way, could lead to another government shutdown by the end of the month, right? Because you have people like Chris Murphy, the Democratic senator who heads the subcommittee on Homeland Security, saying they're not going to endorse this budget. On Tuesday, the Congressional Progressive Caucus vowed to oppose new funding for the Department of Homeland Security unless it includes new reforms. This is Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minneapolis.
We cannot and we should not continue to fund agencies that operate with impunity, that escalate violence, and that undermine the very freedoms this country claims to uphold.
And meanwhile, Tuesday evening, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut and others joined hundreds of protesters outside D.C. headquarters of Customs and Border Protection, said he supports the appropriations bill to push for changes at ICE.
The United States Congress should not fund a Department of Homeland Security that is not obeying the laws of the United States of America.
Ken Klippenstein, are we seeing some changes in Democrats' positions here?
Absolutely. Among Democratic voters, among Congress, there is some opposition, but among congressional leadership, they've made it very clear that they're not willing to shut down the government over this. They asked Senator Cory Booker this, for instance, yesterday on MS Now, and he said no, the last shutdown didn't work. Chuck Schumer had to be dragged kicking and screaming to even do the shutdown earlier this year to play hardball with the Republicans after he folded instantly at the beginning of the second Trump administration. So there are definitely splits within the caucus, but among leadership, there's opposition to the idea. That being said, among the public, there's been a sea change in opinion with respect to ICE and the deportations. Where there was more openness to it when Trump first came into office, that picture has completely flipped, and it's a deeply unpopular proposition. And that's what the opposition among the Homeland Security officials that I interviewed for my story are reflective of. They're part of the public, too, to some extent. And they also are seeing all the same videos that we're watching, seeing the same protests, seeing the same public sentiment, and they have a lot of the same feelings about it, particularly the older, more experienced agents who are not the beneficiaries of this tidal wave of funding. I mean, they have more money than they know what to do with. They have tripled ICE's law enforcement budget, and the reason they're doing all of the, you know, you described in the previous segment, the lengths to which they're going to try to staff up, the reason for that is, again, they have more money than they know what to do with, and they need to fill those roles, and they're doing everything they can to create them so that the actual personnel headcount can match the resources that they now have.
Ken, you've also read ICE's deadly force documents that you say, quote, are bureaucratically dense and elastic to the extreme, offering every possible excuse for ICE's killing of Renee Good. But they're also stark in their failure to address any aspect of the dramatically new environment created by ICE's expanded mission. What do they reveal, these documents?
This is maybe the most alarming part of this entire story for me, was seeing that they have not changed the use of force policies for ICE whatsoever since Trump came into office, despite the fact that, again, they have tripled the budget for the enforcement part of it. And in addition to that, just militarized the entire thing. They're wearing masks. They're being deployed in states where the majority of the state population doesn't support them. They're being used in a far more aggressive, sweeping and ambitious manner than ever before. So you would think that there would be some kind of reflection of that in policy, at the very least, not just to protect the public, but to protect them as well. There's nothing in its use of force documents, which you can, you know, go on my newsletter and read in full, that addresses protesters, civil unrest, even rioters, which Trump is always talking about. You can search for those words. None of those words appear in the document. And what's more, we only know what the document says because it was accidentally uploaded by the Trump administration over the course of a federal court litigation. The entire thing was blacked out, redacted, until December of last year. And that's a failure on Congress's part for not compelling ICE to release these things and make them public, especially with an administration that made very clear that this is going to be its signature policy, these mass deportations.
Last question. You've done a lot of reporting on Trump's new presidential directive, NSPM 7, National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, a sweeping order that directs federal agencies to treat political dissent as a form of domestic terrorism, a term that Kristi Noem is throwing around right and left, accusing also deceased, accusing Rene Good of domestic terrorism. Can you put these latest developments in perspective?
Yeah, so there's a straight through line from the shooting of Rene Good to NSPM 7, this presidential memorandum, that, as you said, redefined terrorism around a number of what are called indicators, because you have to try to, terrorism is about pre-crime. You're trying to predict a crime before it has happened. That's what the word terrorism is for. And so how do you predict a crime? Well, you got to look at speech. And what are the speech indicators you're looking for? If you go and read the actual presidential directive, it literally says things like anti-Christian sentiment, anti-American sentiment, anti-traditional family sentiment, anti-capitalist sentiment. And it describes, one of the things it describes is anti-ICE protesters and sentiment, which is exactly what we saw. Moreover, the Justice Department released a sort of follow-on memo citing NSPM 7, and one of the things that it was concerned with was, quote, impeding or interfering with ICE operations, which is exactly what Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem and the Trump administration accused Rene Good of doing by having her car parked in the middle of the road. So there is a straight line from NSPM 7 to the tragedy that we saw unfold last week.
And finally, you say ICE is okay with Rene Good's killing. Why?
Because its policy all but allows its ICE agents to carry these things out, and the only thing restraining them is their own perceived sense of being in danger. That is not a policy you have in place if you want them to carry out their responsibilities in a circumspect way. Because not only can they say whatever they feel they perceived, because we obviously can't, we don't have a window into their mind, but in addition to that, all the propaganda you've been describing earlier about them being deployed to war zones, and literally that's how they're recruiting ICE agents at that point, that creates a psychological environment in which they genuinely believe that. And that has been another aspect of reporting on this that surprised me. They don't see it as rhetoric. They think that that's actually describing the conditions on the ground, a war zone, as your previous guest described it, you know, the war on terror come home. That is overwhelmingly believed by the younger cohort that's joining ICE now, and they need to be restrained by firmer policies than that their own perception was that they were in danger.
Ken Klippenstein, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Investigative reporter. We'll link to your recent articles at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We turn now to look at immigration detention expansion in Trump's second term. That's the focus of a new report released today by the American Immigration Council. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by the council's senior fellow, Aaron Reichland Melnick. Aaron, welcome back to Democracy Now! Lay out your findings on who's being arrested, who's being detained, where they're being detained, and the size of these jails.
Yeah, what we are seeing and what we lay out in this report is that ICE detention has expanded dramatically in Trump's first year back in office. It is, the entire system is 75% larger today than it was when he took office, with, as of this week, 70,000 people being held in detention on any given day, up from 40,000 when President Trump took office. And that is driven by the new arrest policies, which are leading to the mass detention of people with no criminal record whatsoever. In fact, the single largest increase in ICE detention usage is among people who have had no interactions with the criminal justice system at all, who are being arrested in these brand new sweeping policies, such as the use of roving patrols, worksite raids, and the arrest of people at courthouses and immigration check-ins.
You note that changes in ICE's arrest practices have led to a well over 2,000% increase in the number of people with no criminal records being held in ICE jails on any given day, Aaron.
That's right. In fact, if you look at just the last few months, since the start of fiscal year 2026, so October 1st, 92% of the growth in ICE detention has been among people who have no interaction with the criminal justice system. The system in general expanded by about 5,000 beds over that period, and almost all of that increase came among people who have no criminal record, no prior convictions, or pending criminal charges. An unprecedented situation for immigration detention.
Can you talk about the unprecedented scale of federal funding for ICE in Trump's new term? With the funding provided by what he calls, and many deride, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, ICE has enough money to operate upwards of 135,000 detention beds through the end of 2029. Congress voted to give ICE a total of $45 billion for ICE immigration detention through the end of the fiscal year 2029.
That's right. So when Trump took office, ICE's budget was for detention was $3.4 billion. That is a staggering sum of money already, and it let ICE detain on average 41,500 people on any given day. But thanks to the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act, ICE now has an average annual budget of $15 billion over the next 4 years. By comparison, the entire Federal Bureau of Prisons, their budget is less than $9 billion. So ICE's detention budget alone is larger than the entire budget of the federal prison system. And that puts ICE on track by the end of Trump's second term in office to rival the federal prison system in sheer size.
So does this rapid expansion of immigration detention also lead to more deaths? Let's remember, most of the people in these jails have not committed any crime.
Yes, and we have already seen 2025 be the deadliest year on record for ICE detention. And four people have died in ICE detention just in the first 2 weeks of 2026. So we are on track for another deadlier year. And that's because they are rushing people through the system and expanding too quickly. When they put a new tent camp online in Texas on Fort Bliss that is set to hold 5,000 people called Camp East Montana, in the first month that it was open, internal government watchdogs found dozens of violations because they were throwing together the facility so fast that they couldn't have it fully prepared and safe for the people in it. And indeed, one of the four deaths this year did occur at that facility.
Mm. And can you also talk about just overall the overcrowding and the state detention methods under Trump's second term with jails like Alligator Alcatraz, which is entirely run by Florida? And also, can you talk about the targeting of people with DACA, with green cards? I mean, people who are legally here and working.
Yeah, so one of the biggest things that we document in this report is changes in policies that have led to people being detained who would not have previously been detained or would have been at least only temporarily detained and then released on bond. And that includes many people with sympathetic factors, people with green cards, people with DACA, who may have had a minor interaction with the criminal justice system, but not enough to justify long-term detention. But this administration, on day one, saw President Trump issue an executive order mandating that ICE use detention to the maximum extent possible. And that means that they are not releasing people. And that's led to severe overcrowding as they arrest people more quickly than they can hold them in detention. That's led to people being shuttled around the country from place to place, sometimes being sent to a dozen different detention facilities as ICE moves people around to free up beds in one place so that they can put another detainee there. And so the result of that is a system where overcrowding is going on, the conditions are getting worse. Add to that, the Trump administration worked with Florida to create a brand new model of immigration detention, one run entirely by the state and barely supervised whatsoever by the federal government. This is the infamous so-called Alligator Alcatraz, the Everglades detention camp where hundreds of people are held. And that tent camp in Florida is the model for Trump's new expansion of ICE detention, with Camp East Montana on Fort Bliss, 5,000 people to be detained there, and they are looking at more military bases to hold people, and even potentially looking at warehouses, converting them into facilities to hold maybe upwards of 10,000 people at a single place. But crucially, all of this has been slower than they wanted. Their hope was to have over 100,000 people in detention by today. They've hit 70,000. The number keeps going up, but they have not yet been able to fully expand to the extent that they want. And I think that's a good thing because the situation is going to get worse.
Aaron Reichlin Melnick, thanks so much for being with us. Senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. We'll link to your new report out today, Immigration Detention Expansion in Trump's Second Term. Next up, the Supreme Court appears poised to uphold state bans on transgender youth participating in school sports. Back in 20 seconds.
Your permission to mess around. Bad news in the foreground. To stay home while feeling down. To wait and see what's going on. About getting more education. About the way of tradition. About the politics and elections.
Need by Laurent Michel Lombard. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The conservative majority Supreme Court signaled Tuesday it'll rule to uphold state laws in Idaho and West Virginia that ban transgender girls from participating in school sports. Two transgender girls, one in Idaho, the other in West Virginia, wanted to be part of their school's track teams, but state laws prevented them from participating. Soon after taking office, President Trump signed an executive order to direct federal agencies to withdraw funding from schools that allow transgender youth to compete in women's sports. This is ACLU attorney Chase Strangio.
In this moment, in so many halls of power, it feels like people are debating whether or not transgender people exist, whether or not we deserve protections under our Constitution and our civil rights statutes. And today in the Supreme Court, we were able to remind the nine justices that we do exist, that we deserve protections just like everybody else, and that there has been a history of discrimination against us that warrants the court to take a closer look at the type of government targeting that we've seen over and over again from states and now from the federal government. Thank
you. We're joined now by Karen Lowy, Senior Counsel and Director of Constitutional Law Practice at Lambda Legal. In the Supreme Court yesterday, part of the legal team representing the trans student athletes. Can you tell us their stories and what do you think the Supreme Court signaled with their questions yesterday, Karen?
Sure. So Becky Pepper Jackson was 11 years old when she tried to join her school's track and field team. She was starting middle school. She was excited for the opportunity to be part of the team and make new friends and have all the experiences that team participation brings for a young person. Becky is a trans girl. She has she comes from a family of runners and athletes and was excited to be part of it. And to our knowledge, is the only trans girl who wants to participate in school athletics in the entire state of West Virginia.
I want to turn to Becky Pepper Jackson in her own words when she first filed the lawsuit at the time she was 11 years old.
I first tried out for a school sport my sixth grade year for cross country. Everyone in my family is runners, so it was nice to get like help from them. I originally wanted to try out for the long distance team because that's what I had known and loved from cross country and running with my family. But my coach told me that if I were to just go for long distance, I wouldn't have made the team because it was much more competitive during track season. So she encouraged me to try shot put and discus, which as it turned out, I really loved. Being able to compete alongside my peers was really fun for me because it taught me teamwork. I made a lot of friends, but most of all, I just had fun, and that's all I wanted to do. When my mom told me about the fact that I wouldn't be able to play the sports that I love, I was devastated. I asked my mom what my options were, and they said that we could talk to the ACLU and Lambda Legal, and that's when we filed our lawsuit with them.
So that's Becky Pepper Jackson. And can you tell us, Karen Lowy, about the other girl?
Sure. So Lindsay Hecox is a college student, and she wanted also to try out for the track team. And Idaho, similar to West Virginia, passed a law excluding all trans athletes from participation on women's sports teams. And the states have attempted to justify these things in terms of some sort of alleged sex-based athletic advantage. That's the reason. Well, for Lindsay, who had been on hormone therapy for over a year, there were findings in the district court that she had no athletic advantage because of the hormone therapy she had undergone. And for Becky, it's the same. She tried out for the track team and didn't make it. She wasn't good enough. But she also then had the opportunity because of the injunction to participate in club sports, club running, club soccer. And she is on track to graduate in the next year and a half or so. And we are, you know, fighting for these young people to be able to participate equally in their school programs.
Karen, let me ask you about Justice Amy Coney Barrett raising a hypothetical about, I think she said, boys who didn't make the boys' team switching to girls' teams. We only have a minute to go, so can you talk about this fundamental misunderstanding of trans identity? And also, given the court 6-3 conservative majority, seeming poised to uphold the bans, what immediate national implications are there?
You know, that does fundamentally misunderstand the nature of who a trans girl is, but it also misses the point. This isn't about the girls' teams being worse and the boys' teams being better. Title IX was about equal educational opportunity, including in sports. You know, there are lots of ways that the court could rule. I think there are ways that this could be a very narrow, limited ruling about sports in particular. But we will see. It's really about whether the court is going to uphold the trans people's equal opportunity in all aspects of public life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Karen Lowy, Senior Counsel, Director of Constitutional Law Practice at Lambda Legal, was in the Supreme Court yesterday for oral arguments. Will the Supreme Court uphold bans on transgender girls participating in girls' sports? That does it for our show. Tomorrow on Democracy Now, we'll be joined by the acclaimed Iranian filmmaker, Jafar Panahi. Tune in then. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terrasane, and Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Safwat Nizal. Our executive directors, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Carl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Torrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. Also tune in for our special, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. special on Monday, Martin Luther King Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
some politicians love to tell us that we have to choose between policies that support people or policies that grow the economy. But we don't have to choose. A strong economy isn't only about stock markets and GDP. It's about all of us being able to afford our rent, our groceries, our medication. When we all thrive, the economy thrives too. Together, we can demand better. Take action at demandbettertoday.ca.